Good evening. This is Phil Elwood in 1966. We're about to hear a rebroadcast from the series of presentations which I produced in the summer of 1957 as a 10th anniversary commemoration of the opening of the Lou Waters Yerba Buena Jazz Band's own nightclub, which was called Hambone Kelly's, located in Albany, California. I have 8 of these half-hour tapes, plus a good deal of additional material which I have acquired since these 1957 original programs. Rather than trying to patch together a brand new series, including the old and some of the more recent acquisitions, I've chosen to play the original series of 8 programs intact, with all their dated references and occasional engineering difficulties, most of which occur only on the first tape, I might add. And then at the conclusion of these original 8 programs, in a couple of months, I will have produced 4 more as a kind of an appendix series, making a full dozen weekly half hours of reminiscences with the Yerba Buena Jazz Band of San Francisco. I'm doing it for this way for 2 reasons. In the first place, I've received, since the initial programming, 9 years ago, at least 250 communications of one type or another, requesting a rebroadcast of the series. Another reason for this reprogramming of these broadcasts is that this is the 25th anniversary of the original organization of the Yerba Buena Jazz Band in its pre-war Dawn Club form, and therefore it seemed logical to me that this was a likely time to redo the whole business again. Also, there's some wonderful music here, most of which you have never heard before, because it is from private source material, original acetates, other radio stations' files, off-the-air broadcasts, and so forth. So let's go back 9 years to the Summer Jazz Archives of 1957 and Lou Waters and the Yerba Buena Jazz Band. It has been my custom for the past 6 years to devote the Summer Jazz Archives broadcast almost entirely to miscellaneous selections from my record library, without any attempt at program format or continuity. This summer, beginning with tonight's presentation, I'm going to spend 6 or 8 weeks in what I hope will be fond recollection for many of you, for whether or not we want to recall or not, we have to concede that it now has been 10 years since traditional New Orleans-style jazz had its finest hour. The revival spirit in jazz was at its peak in 1947, and the principal center of this enthusiasm was located at the unlikely junction of Wildcat Creek and San Pablo Avenue at the Albany-El Cerrito city border. 10 years ago, with the paint still damp and the Sally Rand signs still discernible, Lou Waters and his Yerba Buena Jazz Band opened their own nightclub, and the legend of Hambone Kelly's was begun. That same year, a young pianist named Brubeck was vainly seeking listeners at a free noon-hour series of recitals on the university campus in Berkeley. But as he later commented, the whole town was square. It was like a disease. The traditional jazz infection spread from the university crowd and within it. Hambone Kelly's often had close to 1,000 customers a night. The Waters Band drew an ovation wherever it went. It truly seemed to the old-timers who had nurtured along the often microscopic interest in early jazz as if the millennium had arrived. These days were, unfortunately, rather short-lived, and equally tragically, poorly documented on inferior recording apparatus. However, through the haze of a decade and the scratch of acetate discs, I hope in the weeks ahead to bring music and commentary from the Yerba Buena Jazz Band, which will prove enjoyable and enlightening to the vast populace for whom jazz, 10 years ago, automatically meant New Orleans style and Lou Waters. Remember Strutting with Some Barbecue, Snake Rag, magnificent work by Waters and Scobie, and Annie Street Rock. Thank you. Strutting with some barbecue, Snake Rag, Annie Street Rock, 1947, Lou Waters, the Yerba Buena Jazz Band. For background commentary throughout this summer series, I consider myself very fortunate to be able to make use of members of the Yerba Buena Band themselves. And certainly the most fitting introductory remarks could only be made by the man whose band this was. And so on Monday last, choosing inadvertently the hottest day the town of Cotati has known in a dozen or more years, I journeyed up to the North Bay area, and sitting out on a very warm porch and far too close, I fear, to a bird sanctuary which Lou has, we recorded remarks concerning Hambone Kelly's and a number of observations concerning jazz in general. We'll start in now with the introduction which Lou did especially for this series. It seems as if Jazz Archives implies traditional jazz, and traditional jazz in the Bay region implies Lou Waters. And in what some people call your retirement, from what I can see here, sitting in your hacienda on what must be the hottest day of a number of years, I think it's gracious of you to have me up here and talk, and I know very much that there are so many questions that people would like to ask of you concerning not only the band, but yourself, and specifically on this 10th anniversary of the opening of Hambone Kelly's, which, for better or for worse, is still the last stand for the Waters Band. I think that we should start in a bit by possibly recapping a little bit of what you've been doing and thinking about in the years since Hambone's closed. So welcome to the archives, and you can kind of take over from here for a while.
Okay, Phil, thanks a lot for the introduction. Since leaving Hambone's, I mean, you just don't forget about music at any time. I mean, once in a while I get a terrific urge to grab the old horn and try to blow a note or two, but all of that's more or less behind me. And up here in Cotati, I'm planning to open a small drive-in restaurant sometime in the near future, maybe a year off, maybe 2 years.
When you say that you're out of music and you've laid down the horn, does this imply, or can we consider that this is a statement for once in person that, as far as you know, you're not going to organize a band or play again?
That's correct. I mean, I toyed with the idea possibly of making some more records, but I don't know for sure if I'll even get to that.
Have you had any interest in picking up, not necessarily traditional, but perhaps taking advantage of the tremendous boom in all forms of jazz and just fronting a studio group?
No, that doesn't interest me. I can use a dollar like the next man, but I figure there's other ways to pick it up rather than get into that.
Do you have any bitterness at all about the, the ultimate demise of Hambone's or the Waters Band, or do you feel that you did the best that you could and that it was inevitable that eventually things would have to fold up?
No, I don't have any bitterness about the whole thing. I look back on it, there was some dark moments and moments of anxiety and some trouble among different members of the band and the business organization at Hambone Kelly's, but when I look back on it now, I guess I see the lighter side of it, and I get more laughs out of it than I do bitter thoughts. I mean, it's a thing that it's past, and we enjoyed it, despite numerous struggles and I look back on it as a pretty good thing. I mean, it's the good moments overshadow the bad ones, let's put it that way.
Well, Lou, you started Hambone Kelly's as an idea, really, before you had the idea of coming over to the East Bay. I know that. The name, as a matter of fact, wasn't decided upon until relatively late, was it? I know you used to have a tune that was Hambone Kelly's, but did it go much further than that?
No, that was about all there was to it. It was a... fondness, let's say, for the name. I mean, it was a low-down, down-to-earth name that we took a fancy to, and finally pinned it on to the old place in El Cerrito.
When you were looking around, maybe it would be wise for the two of us to recap what... it's pretty old history now. You were looking around for a place to have the band play because the Dawn Club had been closed down, what, January 1st, 1947, wasn't it?
That's...
it was the tax problems at the Dawn Club and your band practically at the peak of its popularity and success, I think, don't you?
Yes, that was a very good period.
You were left homeless with a tremendous audience. Generally speaking, do you think the times had a lot to do with the success of your band and traditional jazz, or do you think that it was just a generation that was trying to have their fun after the war?
Well, I think it was a combination of both, that our music was enjoying a certain amount of popularity at that time, and yet, on the other hand, the times were in our favor, too, like they were for other types of music. I mean, people were out, naturally, at the end of a war, they were out to relax and enjoy themselves.
Well, yes, but and yet, within a couple or 3 years, not only the Waters Band, which it must be admitted was going a good deal heavier on quantity... your eight-piece band was a little bit heavy in the numbers even that early. And in the last few years, the bands have gotten smaller and smaller. I mean, the offsprings of the Yerba Buena group, Scobie and Murphy, have both had to cut down, sometimes only to four, five pieces. Do you think yourself that the tax situation had a good deal to do with the lack of success among the bigger traditional bands?
I think it definitely played an important part in possibly holding back that type of music with a fuller combination. I mean, it's always easier to book trios, quartets, and quintets into nightclubs than it is anything larger. I mean, the proprietor has a space problem, he has a tax problem, and it's too bad that it's that way, but it's that's the way it is. And even at Hambone's, as you remember, we started out with eight pieces, and we wound up, I think, with five or six. And you'd wonder, you'd say, well, two or three more or less, what difference does it make? But it's enough to break your back when you're in business. I may have deviated a bit there, but...
I don't think you did at all, because I think it's a very important aspect, especially in your case, because much of the sound of the larger Yerba Buena band was occasioned by the presence of, well, the second horn, for instance. That was unusual. In fact, it was unique. There are very few other bands that have even attempted it since the Oliver days. In addition to that, I think the use of the brass bass and maybe even the second banjo got a sound that was your sound. So I think that it's important that the fact that the club was owned by the band and the band had to crack the nut one way or the other, they weren't only suffering financially by having to maintain a large band, but the fact is that they bands that have tried to do what the Yerba Buena band did, and whether or not Hambone Kelly's financially was ever solvent is completely in spite of the fact that it was, for a couple of years at least, a very healthy and joyous spot for people to go. I think you've said other places, and I think that it's worth repeating, that a great many people who came into Hambone Kelly's actually came because of the atmosphere and weren't that interested in the music.
Yeah, a good number of them. Of course, there was always a certain percentage of the crowd that were very familiar with the music, but at certain times, at certain periods at Hambone's, a good number of people were there that enjoyed the atmosphere of the place. They may have enjoyed it just as well if you'd had one of another dozen groups there instead of ourselves. We, of course, hope to be able to keep on the full eight pieces there. But it just was not possible. And even when I think back on it, we had some fair crowds there, and people come in there on weekends, figured the band was getting rich. There'd be 1,000 people in there, 800. But it wasn't quite that easy.
And it certainly wasn't quite that easy for me either, I might add, trying to record that with Lou. We have a great many more other remarks concerning primarily musical attitudes by Lou Waters, traditional jazz, contemporary jazz, the problems, the failures, the successes of the Yerba Buena band, commentary not only by Lou Waters, but also by Bob Helm, Turk Murphy, and other members of the Hambone Kelly's and Dawn Club Yerba Buena Jazz Band. Those will be continuing on through the summer as part of this series devoted to the Yerba Buena band. To conclude this broadcast, here is the kind of thing which happened every night, it seemed, at Hambone Kelly's when things were going well. Lou kicked off a tune, and for 7 or 8 minutes, the band and the mob would shake that thing. An example of the kind of thing that Lou was talking about and that many of us remember, the fantastic intensity, the drive, and the power of the Yerba Buena band when the two trumpet frontline section would get going with Turk Murphy driving from the back, Wally Rose on the piano, Dick Lammy on the bass, and all the rest of them. This ends the first program in this summer's series devoted to the Yerba Buena Jazz Band. Young musicians were paying outlandish prices for Lou Waters' recordings and methodically copying them off. Good notes and bad alike. Here's one of the band's standard tunes, although it was curiously never commercially issued. From 1946, the Yerba Buena Jazz Band and a Waters original, Yerba Buena Strut.
Yerba Buena Strut by the Lou Waters Band in 1946. In the pre-war days, it was usually a small core of record collectors who supported jazz interest. By 1946 and 47, after Herculean efforts by all manner of jazz do-gooders, the traditional forms, at least, had become fairly fashionable among the public at large. And yet in the United States, by 1950, it was virtually impossible to keep a jazz band or a jazz club solvent. We are now 20 years away from the beginnings of the Yerba Buena Jazz Band. In discussing those early days and the hazards of running a jazz band and club in general with Lou Waters, he felt quite sure that there would be another revival era for traditional jazz, but I wondered if there still was a nucleus of the devoted traditional jazz fans.
Well, they may not be there now, 2 years from now, or 10 years from now, but I feel that there's always a very good chance that that a cycle will come up again. I feel sure because I have, I believe in the music, that the music is not going down and out. It might taper off and might rise high, but it will always be a potential, how would you put it? It would always be a...
possibly a latent force that's back there that...
it could always come alive and could always enjoy a certain amount of popularity. In other words, I figure it is never dead. It's just, it's circumstances. Wars create things, depressions create things. It was right after the Depression hit. Nightclubs and hotels were emptied. The trend was towards soft music, smaller combinations, and it also fitted the mood of the people. And then you know the story following wars and things like that. Music takes another trend. Jazz, however, is not dependent on these things alone. I mean, I feel that jazz will always be there and will enjoy, if you want to call it, rebirths from time to time. I mean, I don't think they'll ever...
Of course, there are those who I think would disagree, and not in the fact that jazz will always have the popularity, but in what you probably will mean by jazz as compared to what many of them will take to mean the term. I think a large percentage of the modernists feel that the kind of jazz, which we can call traditional or New Orleans, which they would call moldy fig, or two-beat, or whatever you want to call it, that type of jazz is too constricting. They feel, many of the modernists, that the younger musicians these days have been too well schooled in newer, more advanced harmonics that are not allowable within the framework of the older jazz. They feel that it was created by essentially amateur musicians and put on records as such, and if traditional bands are going to continue to play that way, they are merely recreating primitive forms of music, and that the important thing of jazz is to always progress ahead and make use of new things, because it is a young, new music, and therefore that it isn't proper, and it isn't logical, and it isn't right, and it isn't profitable to sit down and merely replay the same old tunes that have been with us for 35 years. Maybe we should get new ones. Your band started in, really, by using records because you couldn't find sheet music. Wouldn't that be a fair thing to say?
Yes, you could put it that records was our only access to learning these tunes.
And you wrote scores from the records at the beginning, didn't you?
At the beginning, we wrote out skeleton scores for the purpose of teaching the tunes to the musicians in the band, with the idea that after they learnt the tunes, they were to forget all about the skeleton arrangements and improvise from there on out. In other words, we could stretch a tune any length we wanted.
No.
It was not set up on a 3.5 minute basis for high society. It could be 3.5 minutes or 10 minutes, and I wouldn't call that a set arrangement.
Well, what would you say about a group of younger musicians, say, a whole other generation, 15 years from now, removed, therefore, about 20 or even 25 from your band that took your records as the basis? Now, if they were doing that, do you think that could be the kind of spark necessary, regardless of your rather natural modesty involving it? What your band did, it's quite likely that it will become a format for others. In other words, they've transplanted music once already, and now they're going to do it a second time. Are they keeping the contact? Do you think they're going to have the same kicks, or would you think that they'd be better off to try to go back to even deeper source material and start in on their own?
Well, I think that they would have access to 15 years from now, they would have access to, let's say, older forms than ours. I mean, they already have today, and they could listen to ours, they could listen to any current jazz band. But no matter which band they liked the most, the sound of, I think that they would develop their own sound, and they'd be better off to look at it that way, that they would go ahead and play it their own way. And learn that, in other words, all they'd get from us, or for that matter, even from King Oliver, would be the tunes. That if they believed in the rhythm of this music and the ad-lib possibilities, all they really need to start with is the tune. They wouldn't have to get it from us, they could get it from anybody. I mean, and once they have that, they can go from there. They might produce a sound better than has ever been produced before in the music. Now, on the other hand, getting to the so-called modern jazz, I'm not against it, yet I see certain weaknesses in it. I've heard, of course, there's good and bad musicians in that, like everything else, but there's such a thing as over-sophistication, which is, to me, one weakness in it. Back in the early 30s, there was a trend that way, especially among piano players. It was an effort to be sophisticated, to get a sound that was weird, different, to get chords that were, let's say, out of this world. Some of the progressive jazz sounds to me today like they're trying too hard just to get that. I don't want to deviate here now into another thing.
You're not deviating at all.
But that is a weakness to me. On the other hand, I will go along with somebody that likes that music from the heart and wants to explore it, all possibilities, explore all the possibilities of it. There's room there, and there's room for liking it. And I do not say that it should be disregarded. On the other hand, I think that there's the freedom in traditional jazz is unbounded. It hasn't been exploited all the way yet. Even despite the great work that Louis has done. I mean, that's, as far as I'm concerned, he's about 99% of all of jazz anyway.
And so observes Lou Waters. And on these next two musical selections, it isn't hard to hear the direct tribute which the Lou Waters band frequently paid to Louis Armstrong and his early bandsmen. First is a classic featuring Turk Murphy on